This is a test tape. To practice copying tapes, this seems to be a problem. Yeah, I got a big hum the last time I taped. This is January 29th, 1982. This is a test tape. Better go on a bit longer than this to get the full effect. The last copy I tried to make earlier had a wave, a background hum which would wave into the speech and then fade out and wave in again. So it seems as if it's something unrolling unevenly. I will try to do this on the regular machine to see if it records all right in the regular machine, the reel. I'm at line 26. I'll try again a bit more. It seems to be okay this time, although it does seem to wave a bit. I just had a phone call from Johnny talking about whether he's going to go to Rockford tomorrow. It's on Greyhound. It costs $23 round trip, and the bus only leaves at 5 and comes back at, 5 or 1, so it's out of the question. So he's going to take our car, and we weren't going to the country anyway. And I hope that this is a better recording. We're now at line 39.
He was one of Carl's students.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Oh, well, Carl had this funny seminar in social service, social sciences, theory evaluation as it applied to policy making. Mm-hmm. And back in the 30s, Ray Penn and Ken Parsons thought that their agricultural economics people needed logic. And they came to the philosophy department and asked them to do it. And Carl and Mr. Otto started doing it, and then Otto got tired of it, and Carl kept on. And eventually, it got to the point where a very large number of those ag econ and agriculture journalism people had a philosophy minor, only they had it all under Carl. They had a philosophy of democracy and logic and advanced logic, and then the theory of valuation, which was really a policy making thing. And over the years, from about 1940 until 49, he had a great many foreign students. Mm-hmm. And then when the GIs came back and they flooded this university, mm-hmm. The philosophy department dropped it because Carl was teaching 4 logic courses for theory
of democracy. That's why he didn't get any writing done, is that right?
And, well...
You know, Bri Curl said, find out why he didn't publish anything.
I can Bri tell Curl. You.
Why?
Carl got the first Wharf grant from that was given to the humanities. Mm-hmm. And I can't tell you what year it was. It was in the 30s. Percy Shred was then dean of the graduate school. Mm-hmm. And he was a very enthusiastic supporter of Carl's point of view. And at that time, Herman Worker, who was in orthopedics, wanted to make a bone rivet in his back. Mm-hmm. And he said, of course, he'd have to spend 6 months on his face and then 6 months on his back. Mm. And Carl said, no, thank you. I haven't got that kind of money. And he said, all right, we'll just break down the adhesions. So Carl did get this grant for a semester. Mm-hmm. And he spent it practically in bed because they were using exercises to break all of the adhesions. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a book on theory, Dewey's theory of evaluation. Mm-hmm. And he gave it to someone to read. and after, before he turned it in to be published, and after a while, he went to get it, and the gentleman said, "It isn't worth reading. I haven't bothered." And Carl, who was a very modest soul, sort of very pensive, well, maybe I don't know what I'm talking about. Well, George Selwery spent 6 years trying to get him to publish it, but he wouldn't.
Oh, dear.
But he went back to doing what he had loved most, teaching.
Yeah, well, that's
because it wasn't that he agreed with Mr. Micklejohn in his philosophy, but the 5 years in the experimental college opened the process of teaching by tutoring,
mm-hmm. yeah.
or by personal contact with the student, to something that Carl never got over.
He liked it.
He liked it more than anything mm-hmm. else. It was worth money. He'd give yeah. any mm-hmm. amount of money and anything in order to keep that.
Mm.
And he wasn't willing to spend the time on writing
mm-hmm.
and take it from that. Well, when the philosophy department said he couldn't get credit for teaching the seminar, he said, "All right." And then some of the people, of whom Abe Weisbot was one, Bob Clodius,
yeah.
Pete Dorner,
huh.
those were the people that
yeah.
came to him and said, "Will you do it for free?"
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Why, of course, we're certain." Mm-hmm. And Abe said, "Well, you can do it at my house." So every Monday night, he went in, and the men who had asked him chose the people. Of course, yeah. Eric was in that.
Mm-hmm.
Eric Lampert was one of those. He was one of the first group.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody got any credit, and nobody got any money. Well, that was fine, only Abe went to India mm-hmm. on a Ford fellowship, and Bob Clodius said, "All right, you can meet at my house," because the same people went on year after year. They didn't, yeah. And Ray Penn was back in it. Oh. The man in sociology, now what's his name? Haven? Van Haven?
Mm.
Joe mm-hmm. Thorpe mm-hmm. of law.
You know, before you go, I think we better start with you, because you'll end up talking about Carl all the time, and really we want to talk about you.
So,
Hannibal was okay.
February 15th, 1901. So you see, I'm a youngster. I was a member of a split family in a border state. My mother was essentially Virginia and Maryland descent.
Mm-hmm.
My father, Connecticut, New Hampshire.
Mm.
And every meal of every day, we fought the battle of the Civil War, which was the war between states. I was supposed to get married. I was engaged at 15 to the son of my mother's maid of honor, which was very usual, family-arranged marriages.
Mm-hmm.
He was at Manhattan University in Kansas,
mm-hmm.
learning to be a chemical engineer. He was about 4 years older than I was. I'd known him. He spent all of his summers in Hannibal. He lived in New Mexico. The war came along, and he joined Harry Truman's artillery brigade and went to France. My father, who was had gone to Dartmouth and believed in the Eastern culture.
What did he do?
My father was a banker. His father was the only Hodgson, H-O-D-G-D-O-N, which is never pronounced right, had been the only Hodgson in 300 years that lived west of the Hudson. So, with my fiancé in France, I was to go to college. I was 17. Mm-hmm. And because my father didn't think much of the schools in the Middle West, I went to Smith because the Hodgson people went to Smith.
That's my alma mater.
Is it?
Yes.
Well, I entered because I was the last class that went in without college exams. In 1918 was the last class that was entered without exams, and I happened to be valedictorian of my class. And it wasn't until I got to Smith that I discovered how ill-prepared I was. I remember the day in fifth-year Latin that I was asked to translate an English sentence into Latin, and I'd never done it in 4 years. Well, I survived.
What did you major in?
I majored in chemistry, which my family thought was awful, but I was crazy about chemistry. And in my junior year, I got into bacteriology. And I got so enthusiastic about it that I not only took advanced bacteriology, but I did a regular seminar with the teacher who had gotten her degree at Cornell, and I was the only person taking it. I did a study of ice cream. You can imagine how I like ice cream. And at the end of that time, I had a chance to be a graduate assistant in three places.
For heaven's sake.
The public health school at Yale, New Haven, Massachusetts General in Boston, and the University of Massachusetts Agricultural College in Amherst.
That's where Anne's been.
That's my old stamping ground.
That's your old stamping ground. Well, my family was horrified. And I sat and refused to get on the train for a week until I got their permission to take that job. I was to be paid $60 a month.
Which one were you going to take?
Massachusetts Agricultural College. Mm-hmm. They thought that was the least dangerous.
They were probably right.
Right. Well, I was allowed to do it provided I let Mother choose the place I was to live. And she picked the Davenport Inn in Amherst, where I paid $50 a month for board and room. So I had $10 to live on. Oh. And my family gave me nothing but my ticket.
Okay.
I had to buy all my books.
You mean they were really put out?
They were absolutely violently opposed
because
to my going on with the graduate work. Mm-hmm. But by that time, the boy that I was engaged to had come home from France. He had the opportunity to go to Toulouse University in the year when he was waiting to be brought back to this country. And he had grown up, too. Mm-hmm. We were very good friends, but we were not ready to get married. Mm. And we never even broached the subject again.
Mm.
Neither of our families approved of that. But, anyhow.
Was it difficult? Did you find it, painful for you to have to do this against your family's wishes, or did you just take it in your stride?
I was the born outlaw in my family.
So
I had an older brother who was at Dartmouth when I was at Smith, and everybody in the family, which is very true of a Southern culture, worshiped the boy and the poor girl. She was just an also-ran.
Mm.
I had a sister, but she was 10 years younger. So actually, everything I did was in revolt. I'd been brought up very conventionally. I'd been taught all of the ladies' things. I knew ballet, was a toe dancer, and I learned China painting and Irish crochet and tatting and punch work and everything that a lady was supposed to do, but she wasn't supposed to be interested in science. However, when I got into science, I discovered that the one thing I really loved was science. And chemistry, physics, and bacteriology were just my meat. But I had very poor advice because I went through theoretical chemistry without calculus. And after I got to Amherst, the head of my department, Dr. Charles Marshall, who was a very noted bacteriologist, was also dean of the graduate school, where they usually ran in a chemistry minor with their bacteriology, because I was working for a PhD. And I had very good teachers. One of them was Avery, was Roy Avery, whose brother was in the Rockefeller Center working on vaccines. And one of them was Eero Otano, who was a Japanese who had been sent to this country before he was of military age, had worked with Sorensen in Copenhagen, and came back, and between us, we built the first pH tester in this country.
Oh. Really?
I learned to even blow gas to make the equipment because it wasn't it wasn't available. I got a wonderful training in Massachusetts Agricultural College. I was working on a problem that was requested by the department, by the canning association. We were trying to find out how to can vegetables without that weren't acid. And my particular study was a study of the spore cycle of Bacillus subtilis, which is the thing that causes botulism and so many of the things. Degree of salinity, amount of heat, length of time, and all of it. So you didn't have much. And by the end of my, by December of 23, I'd finished my experimental work. And Mr. Otano went to the bacteriology meetings and presented my paper as a new thing on, in bacteriology.
Did you get to go to the meeting?
In January, the Journal of Bacteriology came out, and somebody in Wisconsin at the experiment station had finished his thesis on the same problem. The fact that we agreed had nothing to do with it. They just said, go ahead and start all over again. Well, that was a little hard to take. And I didn't know whether I was going to take any more.
Had you gotten your PhD?
No, 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 no.
You hadn't written your thesis.
I hadn't written my thesis. Yeah. I had to have 2 years of residence. And I had taken all of my classwork.
Yeah.
Okay. I had taken my minor was math and physics. And I had a very peculiar situation because I was the only graduate student at Aggie in either department. So I had private tutorials. The physics department found themselves with a man who had scarlet fever, and somebody had to be brought in to give his courses, so I was chosen to run the freshman physics course for 6 weeks, and I did, and they decided I didn't need an oral to pass. The math department was deep in probability. Niels Bohr, the Dane, had just been to Amherst for a week's conference, and I was the only graduate student from Aggie that was allowed to go down and go to all of his lectures. Mm-hmm. I had a wonderful time. And they decided that if I could present the probability theory to the Department of Bacteriology, I didn't need a math thing. They decided that if I wanted to pass my German exam, I was given a textbook in German to translate. It had not been translated into English. Management took me about a year to do it. My French exam was that every month I reported the Institute of Pasteur analysis to the department. Which is, I would say, putting such examinations on a practical.
Oh, it was a great idea.
But it was also, well, I had 44 hours of classwork. Carl was living in the Davenport Inn at the same time.
It all comes together.
Well, was he going to Amherst?
No. Carl was a graduate of Aggie, who had lost 2 years by being in the service during World War I. Originally of the class of 19, he graduated in 21.
From Mass Ag?
From Mass Ag. Oh. He had gone up there to be a landscape architect.
Oh, I see.
And having lost 2 years in the service, he decided to take his degree in rural sociology because he had more electives. He did, and he didn't have a job. And he decided to sell aluminum. So he went to Connecticut with his aluminum wherever, and read Eliot and various and sundry other people all summer. And then he decided he better get some money. So he went and weeded beets, rather than sell wherever, and went back to the QTV house, which was his local fraternity, because he could live there on milk and shredded wheat without paying anything. And he met his old, the director of the amateur theatricals in Aggie, Professor Rand. And Rand said, come up and see me.
Frank
so,
Prentice Rand?
Frank Rand.
Oh.
Frank Prentice Rand. Yes, you know. And Kyle was very fond of Rand. He came out here one summer while we were here and worked with one of the people in English. Anyway, he offered Kyle a job teaching English if he would take graduate work down in Amherst. So that was fine. He went home, he got ready for the fall semester, and came back, and the man that he'd done his rural sociology under, whose name I've forgotten, said, Carl, I want somebody to be a tutor, to live in with a boy who's being sent up from Boston. He was a moron, one of the wealthy Boston families. And they were sending him up for the short course. And they were willing to pay Carl $100 a month in furnished board and room if he would live with this boy. Well, he agreed to. And it became very evident before very long that there was something radically wrong with this boy. Mm. And he took him over to Dippy, you know, over the insane asylum in Northampton.
Yes.
And he was tested and found to be age 7.
Oh.
And So I went down to the family and told them about it. He didn't think they knew it. Mm. Well, of course, they knew it. They were just covering it up. But anyway, he went back and he stuck out the year. And at the end of that year, which was my first year in Aggie, I went down to the office one day and at the micro thing, and all hell was popping because the one of the women who was an instructor in the math in the bacteriology department was the secretary of the graduate club, and she'd forgotten to order the hoods. This was the Friday before commencement. They had 12 master's hoods and one PhD. Nobody could get them in time. And not knowing how to keep my mouth shut, I said, why don't you make them? I ended with the job of making them. And Carl's best friend was the president of the graduate club. And he went along when they took me over to Northampton to buy them with serge and everything, and, you know, all the stuff that I had yet. And we went around borrowing hoods so I could copy them. And between Friday noon and Monday morning, Mary Garvey and I made those 13 hoods. Well, those two men, Carl and this friend, took it upon themselves to be nice to me that summer. And of course, what I did was fall in love. I was down at Amherst taking graduate work, and this was the famous June of 1923 when Alexander Mickledon was kicked out of Amherst. And a third of the faculty resigned with him, and some of the seniors refused their degrees. And they brought everybody and everybody's brother in to fill in the gaps in the faculty. Well, Carl was very disappointed with the quality of the work he was taking the second year. And he was all ready to leave. He was of the lost generation that didn't know what they wanted to do anyway. There were a lot of people who went out of college to the war, who came back, and it took them 8 or 10 years to get back on their feet. Well, I was so disappointed about this whole thing about my thesis that I didn't care whether I did anything or not.
Oh, I see. So you...
So the two of us decided that we'd get married, and we thought maybe we'd take off for Australia. That was offering all sorts of jobs to anybody who was trained. They were just begging for people with training. And so I went home, and we got married in the church. We went over to Newport to get acquainted with his family, and we went to Boston, and the first boat out went to Savannah, Georgia. But one of our stops on the way to Australia was to be Rollins College that had just opened up in Winter Park, Florida.
You know, we're going to, I think we better, because we have to ask you about yourself.
Well, some I'm more. Telling you about myself
okay.
now.
But I mean here in Madison as a...
All right, I've got to get to Madison.
Okay.
It takes me about 3 more sentences.
All right, good. Actually, I'm surprised.
Instead of going to Australia, we went to see the public laboratory in Savannah. And before I walked out of the door, I was offered the job of assistant director of the Chatham County Health Department. We talked about it. Carl wanted to write the great American novel, so I accepted it. we went through all the gestures, borrowed furniture from a friend whom we met accidentally, and I stayed there a year. Carl started writing, then he joined a stock company that was up at Columbia, South Carolina, because he thought he'd leave. And then we suddenly had a daughter, which was rather unexpected. And I gave up my job and started raising her. Now, she was one of these blue babies that don't grow fast.
Mm-hmm.
And I nearly lost my mind. So I decided that the thing for me to do was to get a trained nurse and get a job. And I went to the Marine Hospital in Savannah and was given the job of the laboratory technician, running the whole laboratory. It was a 150-bed hospital. We had a lot of shell shock cases from World War I there, and it had the whole merchant marine, all of the cases from all over the world. And I was there 6 months. And then we decided that I better go back to raising a daughter. Where Dr. Stovall was the head. Told him I was a trained bacteriologist. The fact that I trained under Dr. Marshall was the important point in all these jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Fred knew my Dr. Marshall personally, and so I thought I could get a job up here and put Carl through graduate school.
Hmm.
He didn't have a job or a scholarship. Yeah.
How old was your child by this time?
Not quite a year old.
Mm.
And so we came up here, and Dr. Stovall discovered that Carl was going to be a graduate assistant in the philosophy department, and he said, I don't hire two people in the family. So, there I was. I had no opening in bacteriology because none of the hospitals at that time had laboratories. So, I met Mrs. S.A. Leonard, and through her suggestions, I opened the first nursery school in Madison in the fall of 1926. About 4 months later, Laura Bernstein opened the cooperative one down in Luther Memorial, which became the university nursery school. Those were the first two. And I ran that for 6 years in order to have us have something to eat. The first year, Carl had one graduate assistantship section under Alexander Micklejohn.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Micklejohn asked him to come into the experimental college. But that didn't mean money. $137.50 was what Carl earned. And what I got from the nursery school was what we ate on.
Mm. Who took care of the little girl?
She was in the nursery school.
But I mean, she wasn't all day in the nursery school.
I only had it half a day.
Oh, I see.
But I picked them up in the morning.
Yeah.
Brought them to my house. The visiting nurse came and examined them. I took them home at noon.
Mm-hmm.
Brought her home and put her to bed and whatnot. And I charged $3 a week for each child. I had 12 children, and Jane Bloodgood was my assistant. She was the wife of the minister at Andrew's Church, St. Andrew's Church. The next year, I had a Canadian British registered nurse, Alwyn Winspear's wife. He was in classics. But I always had an assistant because you couldn't have 12 children without two people.
You know, I'd like to know how, since you had been, you had almost gotten a PhD in science, bacteriology, what was it like running a nursery school? Did you?
Well, I didn't like teaching.
Did you feel
teaching.
Frustrated?
Well, I didn't like teaching.
Uh-huh.
However, I'd read so many books about children being brought up that I was determined to not have an only child grow up a spoiled and pampered darling.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I'd lost two children.
Oh.
Anne was one of three blue children that we had over a period of years.
Mm-hmm.
And they told me I could never have any more.
So this was really
my taking care of Anne.
I see.
And the thing that complicated, I loved the rhythm work.
Mm-hmm.
I loved the music. I was able, my school was among the ones of the first White House conference where we had all this new material, flashcards,
mm-hmm.
everything presented to us if we would use it.
Really?
And I had all sorts of help. Kurt Kafka was here as a visiting professor in psychology, the Gestalt man, and the man who was teaching retarded reading up in the public education, the public speech department helped me. Carl was taking his minor in psychology.
Mm-hmm.
I had all the help in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Micklejohn wasn't any, he was wonderful with advice. John Goss and Ray Agard both were wonderful about teaching methods. So I had all the help in the world. And I used a lot of the experimental college boys to come in. For instance, a boy who is now a renowned sculptor, John H. Houston, came out and did play work with them. One of the boys came out and taught them carpentry.
Yeah.
Marge Dober sent me one of her graduate students to lead rhythm work with them.
She was in dance.
She was in dance here. She just really was wonderful.
So you were really part of the university
community. I was really a part of the university.
Wife.
The only thing that I wasn't was stayed by the university.
Mm-hmm.
But then it got too complicated to have a child in public school and bring home contagious diseases. Because if Anne had got the measles, I had to move the school someplace else.
Mm.
I used the basement of St. Andrew's Church a couple. Anne got scarlet fever. And the same thing happened.
Yeah.
So it got to the point where there wasn't any choice.
So you stopped it? Or you?
Yeah, well, I just decided that I couldn't do it, so I was going to stop it. I had to take a year off because Carl wanted to write his thesis. And the only way he could write his thesis was take a semester off because he was coming up for an appointment as an assistant professor. Mr. Micklejohn was pushing this, but he had to prove to the philosophy department that he was doing something.
Mm-hmm.
And we thought, well, we could starve for a semester. And I got John Beecher's wife to say she would take our house and run the nursery school.
Mm-hmm.
He was one of the other teachers in the experimental college.
Mm-hmm.
She was a trained teacher in physical education. And so I was going to do that, and then they decided they couldn't afford to rent her house. But they rented another house and took the equipment in the nursery school. But there I was, without anything coming in, and we still had to eat. So we decided that I had to stop this. and just pay attention. By that time, when Carl got an assistant professorship, I think he got, as I remember, I think he got $2,000 when he became an assistant professor. So I dropped that, and that was the last paid job I had.
Did you feel at that point that you wouldn't really need to work, and therefore you decided you wouldn't work? Was it that kind of a decision?
No. It was the middle of the Depression, 1932. There were no jobs, period. We had taken a 15% pay cut at the university, the famous waiver,
yes.
Which was not restored until 1949.
Yeah.
What happened? You see, they were restored this way. The first people that they were restored to were the instructors, then the assistant professors, then the associate professors, and the full professors weren't until 1949. And Anne, our daughter, got her bachelor's at the university in June of 1945, and Carl got his full professorship in October of 45 at $4,400. And during the interval, there was nothing that I could do to make money. I gave free time to the hospital. I went in and did blood counts and urines at Madison General Hospital 2 days a week. I went out
so
to
it
two.
So it wasn't in the nature of what today would be considered a volunteer job, but it was, you were working in a professional kind of way.
Well, yes, yeah. I was working, but I wasn't getting paid for it. And I was teaching weaving and caning and all that at Truax, where the patients had this wonderful workshop that they could come to. And
what was Truax?
Truax was where Truax Field, they trained radio people for the Army. They came for advanced radio.
Uh-huh. And you work. Said you mentioned patients.
Well, they had a hospital out there.
Oh. Was that a mental hospital?
Oh, no.
No,
not a mental hospital. But after all, they did get colds, and some of them were sent.
I see.
Yeah.
So it was like occupational
therapy. Oh, yes. It was like occupational
therapy.
That was what it was. And the Red Cross was doing it. I was doing it under the Red Cross.
Mm-hmm.
We were using Red Cross looms to teach them, the ones that now are out at the mental hospital, children's mental hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And all of that time, if I ran my house, and I still felt it was important, all through grade school and high school, to be home when Ann was home. And we did all sorts of things. Some of the mothers got together and ran four dances a year for them. We called it the Cotillion Club.
For whom?
For the high
the
school,
children.
High
okay.
the kids
yeah.
in Wisconsin High School. And they came, and then we got boys from the other schools to fill out so we had enough men, because you always had more girls than men.
Mm-hmm.
And we charged them $1 a dance. And we chaperoned them.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, our house was where everybody ganged.
Where was it?
Well, when I ran the nursery school, what we couldn't rent a house for it. We bought a house on Hillington. And at 152 Rugby Row.
Oh, Rugby Row, yes.
Rugby, you see,
yeah, I know where that is.
The Hillington subdivision.
I see.
And I had two of Bill Rice's children, and two of Philip Follett's children, Walter Rauschenbusch, and three Bloodgoods. I had all of the problem children. Everybody that, of course, in 1926, the only people who were interested in a preschool training were the very advanced liberals
in
the university.
Sure.
And
yeah.
they were mostly, I had all sorts of faculty children.
Mm-hmm. Then did you move subsequent to that?
Well, we sold our house because we couldn't afford to keep it without the nursery school. Mm-hmm. And we sold it for considerably less than we owed on it, which took us a few years to pay back. My father held the mortgage, and we did, over a period of years, get it completely paid for.
And where did you move to?
And we rented an apartment.
Hmm.
And then we rented a house on Jefferson Street. By this time, I had also gotten involved with the progressives. And the way that happened was that when Bob La Follette Jr. Ran for a full term in 1928, Carl drove Phil all over the state to talk for Bob. And I was called in to talk to all the Negroes because I had been raised in Missouri. Anyway, from then on, any time they wanted free work, I was there. We never joined the Progressive Party when they started it in the mid-30s. Their exclusion of socialists was too much. But I had gotten to know Andy Beemuller, who...
You want to stop and get a drink of water?
Yeah. Who was a socialist from Milwaukee, who came down to the assembly, later became majority whip, later went to Congress,
mm-hmm.
later got defeated, later spent years as the lobbyist for the AFL-CIO with George Meany, had just retired. Andy and his wife were both Quakers, and I got to know them through a Smith girl, Virginia North, who was had gone to Smith and then came here to take her law work. And she became an assistant district attorney in Milwaukee. And when the Beemullers moved here, she wrote me and told me that I'd be interested in them. And Hannah had gone to Vassar, and Andy had graduated at Cornell. Well, they started with Howard McMurray to form a new Democratic Party.
I should tell you, I listened to the tape that you made a few years ago, and so I know a little of the background of that.
But
maybe, since we do have a few other kinds of questions,
yeah,
could you just sum up the kinds of things that you did as a volunteer working for that new Democratic Party?
Starting in 42, I was introduced to John McGonigal, who was the official Democratic chairman of Dane County. He took me to every town in Dane County. I knew every board member of every township, every member of every village. I knew every postmaster in Dane County. I knew thousands of people personally because we would go out. While Anne was in school,
mm-hmm.
I could go out for 3 or 4 hours, and we would go out 2 or 3 times a week.
Mm-hmm. So you had a huge network.
That's right. Absolutely down to earth grassroots.
Mm.
In 44, I worked with Daniel Hone in the liberal group who formed a club here before they officially became part of the Democratic group. And we had the so-called mayor's ticket. Daniel Home was running for governor. Somebody else was running. Earl Stoltman was running for secretary of state. We and two other mayors were on that ticket. And they were trying to get the thing wide enough so that they could elect a senator and some congressmen. And the reason was that the labor people had gone to the Democrats and say, look, we like Bob La Follette, but we've got one voice in Congress. You've got to be able to run congressmen. And everybody and everybody's brother tried to get Phil and Bob La Follette to officially join the Democratic Party. The Democrats in Congress promised Bob seniority, anything he wanted, but they would not do it. They insisted upon going back to the Republican Party. So the labor people, more than anyone else, the labor people and the socialists, and our aim was to get all of the progressives into it. Well, they turned Dane County over to me, and I persuaded Bill Rice to run in 46 for Congress. The Rices were very good at cooperating with the new Democratic Party. And there was a real split in the Democratic Party. There was the conservative wing, of which Bill Carroll of Prairie du Chien was the conservative. Well, I wouldn't say that. Now, in the 5 years that the Experimental College was running, I fed the Experimental College boys donuts and cookies and coffee and cocoa quite regularly. They just descended on us and they'd stay for hours.
Did you enjoy doing that?
Well, certainly. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, I grew up in that tradition where if you didn't have something to eat in somebody's house, you were utterly rude. And I loved that part of it. I loved the people who were in the college. And of course, I knew of the faculty of the Experimental College. I knew a number of them before they came here. I knew D. Otis and Mike Childs, Ray Agard and John Goss, because I'd been an Amherst at the same time they had.
Yeah. You know what interests me? You were a professional woman yourself. I mean, you're what we would nowadays. But most of the other women would not have been professional women. The other wives, isn't that right?
No, that's true. And when I say, for instance, that I remember Joel, his wife, talking about why she had gone back and started work on a PhD. She said, it's gotten to the point where if you aren't a professional woman yourself, you don't belong in the faculty. Now, that wasn't true when we came here.
What did she mean by that?
I think I can give you a better example. Abe Weisblatt's wife was a graduate of Holdup. And they came here and they got into agricultural economics. They went to India. They eventually got in with the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation that developed in the Agricultural Development Council. Having gone along as a wife to these other countries, Jan found that she needed to have something to teach, to be a part of the unit. They didn't have room for unworking people. And she got a master's in French so that she could go and teach French and English and composition.
Was it because she was needed, or she just felt that she didn't have any identity unless she did that?
No, it was that they were desperately needed, and if she couldn't be put to work, Abe had very little chance of getting a job. Mm-hmm. And it became a kinship thing, but it had never been before.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we came here, it was impressed upon us that the women should not interfere.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of people, Mr. Otto was one of them, who felt that the wives should not even take courses at the university.
Why?
They would come in without paying tuition, you see. And that was disapproved of. I know, after all, Carl was on the faculty for over 35 years, and the only time I ever took anything at the university was the semester that Mark Ingram ran a checkup for people who were ready to go out and help teach mathematics.
Hmm. Must have been before the just at the war.
Well, I tell you, as we got into the war, you see, the men were going. They needed people to come in to the public schools, to the libraries. Anything. Dorothy Naplan taught math for years.
Now, what happened at the end
now,
of the
instead
war?
Of my doing math, what I did was I took my bacteriology to the Madison General Hospital and worked in the laboratory.
Yeah.
And instead, I wasn't paid for it. They didn't have any money to pay you. But I think that the whole social atmosphere of women changed radically after the war, after World War II.
It didn't go back, in other words, to what it had been.
Marion Thompson and I were talking about that the other day, and I think it was that it ceased to be disreputable if the woman insisted upon being a trained person.
It was disreputable before.
Absolutely. You were practically a whore.
Were you thought of that as that way? I mean, you were a trained person.
I didn't feel that way.
People
thought of me that way.
Was that ever conveyed to you?
Yes, indeed. Without any question.
By other faculty wives
and by men. Yes, ma'am.
And in what form? Would they make comments?
Well, I was more or less told that Carl would never get ahead if I didn't stop it.
Hmm.
Which particular thing to stop? The nursery school or the Madison General
anything,
or the Democratic
anything.
Party?
Anything.
Who told you that?
Uh-uh.
Oh.
So it was made very explicit?
Very explicit.
Mm-hmm.
I was told who I could have as friends and who I could not.
Mm-hmm.
I never paid any attention to it.
Well, actually,
for instance, you talk about faculty wives. A lot of faculty wives did things in the University League.
Mm.
I always belonged to the University League and paid my dues. But I never did anything. However, during World War II, I was the block captain of the entire 13th Ward to get cans for, I knew who lived in every house of the 13th Ward. I was personally responsible for civil defense training. I had to give first aid training to all these women. I did that for 5 years.
Now, wasn't frowned on, though, by these people?
No.
Because it was during the war?
It was during the war.
So it was all right to be active.
I also, I don't know why I was such a fool, I also checked 31 grocery stores every week to see that they were under the Price administration when Bowles was having it, without being paid. Mm-hmm. They didn't spend money on women.
No.
But that work during the years of the war changed the climate in which women worked. I think that, more than anything else, was responsible for the lessening of the criticism.
Hmm.
So did it start to happen after 1945 that women of your generation began to...
Not my generation, but the next one.
Uh-huh.
Very few of my generation did it.
They tended to stay in the same pattern that they had been in.
Well, you weren't in the dinner party set that Dorothy Naplan was in. I mean, how did you...
Well, I was in...
There were
very many people in the dinner club set. The only dinner club... Well, that isn't quite true. I'll take that back. We were in a dinner club with Paul Clark.
We? You?
Carl too? And I were both in a dinner club.
My goodness.
There was a mixed dinner club.
Never heard of those.
Of some very, very fine people. Ed and Anna Morehouse. Hans and Tessa Reese. Paul and Alice Clark, Bob and Harriet Bunn, Lloyd and Ellen Garrison. They were all highly, the hall, the chemistry man, Norris Hall, they were in it too. And those men, Hans Reese and Paul Clark, were always trying to get me to come back to bacteriology. This was in the early 30s.
Uh-huh.
Now, when Anne went into high school, I thought maybe I could take some time. And for a whole year, I went down and worked in Paul Clark's office in medical bacteriology. He was trying to develop a polio vaccine. And he wasn't successful, but that was his major work. And I would go down and do the things that I could do. And then I would read. And I discovered in the I was determined that whatever my family was engaged in, I was going to run a home for my daughter so she could bring her friends from school, that Carl could bring his colleagues and their wives. I would do the entertaining he wanted, and I did, but it didn't fit in with part-time science. If I had wanted to teach and go back and do that sort of thing, it would have been all right. But that wasn't the part of it that I liked. I liked the really creative work, and that meant really making the science primary.
Yes.
And I was not willing to do it.
So did you actually make a deliberate choice to yourself? You thought about it.
I did, and I said no.
And what do you think now about that?
I think I made the right decision.
Mm-hmm.
What I did do, instead of becoming a professional scientist, I poured all my energy into the political side.
Mm.
Carl was intensely interested in seeing a two-party system built up in this state, but he didn't have time for it.
Mm-hmm.
But I had the time, so I did it, and I became, I knew practically every ward in Madison.
Mm.
I walked them, I copied poll lists, I burned up 22 years of politics when we came out here. Papers and I had given copies to the state office when there was a fight within the office and Charlie Green stole all the papers. I furnished Bob Tien with duplicates of all of the second district poll list, which is one of the reasons why I got to be named National Committee Woman. But I poured into volunteer work the energy that many people put into paid jobs. But into social life. Mm-hmm. Now, we had a lot of social life. We had, when we were first here, we belonged to a group of young people who had potluck suppers every Saturday night, and everybody brought their own records, and we danced in each other's houses. And you see, Carl was older than the average. He was almost 30 when he started graduate school.
Yes, yes.
And the people who were his contemporaries, like Lloyd Garrison and Mal Sharp and all these people, adopted him as their colleague, and they were much, much more advanced in. We were the only poor people in it.
Right. Mm-hmm. These were all junior faculty members.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, Lloyd Garrison was the dean of the law school.
Oh.
Mal Sharp went to Chicago Law School after he left the...
Lloyd Garrison was one of the
wonderful person
that's ever been here.
And he brought some of the most wonderful people here. Willard Hurst is one of them. And Bob Bunn, you see, was another one of the people that... George Bunn's father. Brought him down here. And we knew that whole gang. And Nate Feinsinger was on the faculty. We were contemporaries of these people, but we were still poor.
Well, your social life must have been much more informal from the way you describe
that
it
is.
And more fun, and you weren't getting out the silver candlesticks so much, or did you do much of that?
I did a lot of entertaining. Whenever anybody came, like, for instance, when Black came from Ithaca, we'd have all of the philosophy department out here, and I'd be the only one who would think of giving a dinner. It was a little expensive, but I got so that, burgundy stew, you know.
Did you enjoy doing it?
Oh, I loved it.
And you never minded, did Carl help at all?
Oh, no. For heaven's sake. He was a good cook.
But I mean, did he help with cleaning up or?
Nothing.
Oh, did you always? You always during those years did your own housework.
Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm. The only time I ever had any help before I started writing Fertile Eggs, which I haven't gotten to yet, was when I was National Committee Woman. My pay for being National Committee Woman, in theory, I was supposed to get my expenses. In other words, my telephone bills and my traveling expenses if I had to travel. In practice, I didn't get it. And we paid the Democrats' bills and then hoped we'd be repaid. Sometimes we were and sometimes we weren't. And
what were the years that you were Democratic committee woman?
I was secretary of the Dane County Democratic Society from 1942 to 1948. I was second district chairman for the Democratic Party, 46 to 48. I was national committee woman from 48 to 51. And when Bob Tien, who was the national committeeman, was appointed as a judge in Milwaukee, we managed to persuade the state to appoint Carl Thompson, who was one of the young progressives we'd gotten over, as National Committee Woman on the consideration that I resigned as National Committee Woman because both officers could not be from the same county.
Yeah. Mm.
Because Tom Fairchild asked me to, he was Attorney General, you see, I didn't resign until after the 50 election. The only reason was because I was the only person who knew people in Washington. And since I was the contact, and Carl hadn't gotten any contact with the war, so, and then when I resigned, Mrs. Hone, who was from Milwaukee County, became National Committee Woman. And then I completely dropped out because I felt it was imperative that the young people who we'd spent 10 years getting into the party be given the control of it, particularly the women who resented thinking that I knew anything. They thought they knew everything, and the easiest way to do it was for me to say, no, get out. Well, that was good sense, and it's easier to get out completely than to seem to get out. So all I ever did after that was sign my name to a check. And I didn't get back into politics at all, with the exception of supporting people like Gaylord Nelson and Robert Kastenmeyer, until the spring election of 1980. And the town of Dunn, which is where we live, elected two members of a three-member county board who decided to completely destroy everything that had been accomplished in 25 years and take over a dictatorship and turn it into a giant condominium place. Well, I was literally horrified, because I'd been studying town laws since 31, and I knew that the basis, the absolute democratic basis of government in Wisconsin was the democratic town meeting, participation of the voters. So I started getting interested in the town politics, and of course I'm in over my neck. You can't go in partly.
I see them.
Well, it's fine. It's been wonderful for me because after Carl died, having been, he'd been retired, and that meant 24 hours a day here, even when he was giving a seminar. For 17 years, it's a little hard to suddenly find yourself alone. But during that period, we had pretty much drifted out of our old group. Carl got more and more immersed in the land tenure group.
Oh, I see.
And I got out of politics. And what I started to do was just have a garden and manage my end of the farm. We had 67 fertile acres that we farmed on shares. And so I sold the corn and the hay and the oats and so on. And I started to raise a few chickens. And then Charles Tato, who was the lawyer for American Scientific Laboratory, which is a vaccine place out here, is now a part of the Shearing Drug Company of New Jersey, came to me and asked me if I would be willing to raise fertile eggs for their, for them to use to inoculate the chicken diseases, Newcastle and all that sort of thing. And they wanted it because I had the bacteriology back of it.
Oh, my goodness.
I had to stop.
What year was this?
Well, this was in 54.
So it was right after you'd gotten out of politics.
Yeah. So I started in. I'd been raising a few chickens, so I had my own fresh eggs and my own chickens to eat, fattened on corn and buttermilk, like I'd been taught in Missouri. You know, down in Missouri, the only thing you eat is fried chicken. Well, at least it's one of the things. And my grandfather had been, had had a dairy herd for certified milk for babies way back when, before they pasteurized. He ran about 1,000 acres. Of course,
so this
help.
Was in your blood.
Yeah. And so of course when I'd been in agriculture, in Aggie, I did all of the certified milk for the state of Massachusetts. All the tests of that. All the water. Oh yeah, they sent them to the laboratory and I ran them. And I had been thoroughly trained in public health, bacteriology. That when I'd been in Savannah, we'd been part of the first hookworm survey that was paid for by the Carnegie Institute in 1925.
Does this predate the CDC?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh yeah.
But it turned into the CDC, or was that entirely different? The outfit in Savannah that you had, the lab.
The lab was the Chatham County Public Health.
Oh, but thing. Didn't you mention I thought it was a federal or a government.
Well, I was in the government Marine Hospital.
Oh, that's what it was.
That's where I got into diagnosing leprosy. Mm-hmm. But anyway, I started doing fertile eggs for these people. I raised 45 cases a month. And there are 30 dozen in a case of fertile eggs, and I did it for 15 years without a flock getting infected. So I think I earned my stripes. Mm-hmm. Well, I had to keep people out of my barn.
You did
that. Everybody that went into that place had to walk through Lysol, and I had all these they were tested every month. To be sure that they
had to be fertile but sterile.
Fertile but sterile to chicken diseases. There were two or three particular. Newcastle was one of them. And what's the one that? Oh, I can't remember these things. Anyway, there are certain diseases that chickens have that they can inoculate with vaccine. And these eggs were used to grow those cultures that were made into vaccines.
So they couldn't have antibodies.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. They couldn't have antibodies. Yeah. And it was hard work. I worked 6 to 8 hours a day. I didn't have time to do anything else. I had help with cleaning eggs. I got Lucille Miller, who is I met through the progressive thing. She was a very fine person. And she came out and helped me. And I had a man who had no connection with any farm who came out and did the heavy work for turning the litter and all. Mm. But I would have a flock. Bring them to, I would keep, graze the pullets and raise the cocks separate. And then when they were just about ready to lay eggs, I would put them in. I had 500 in a flock. I had two flocks of 500 and a replacement flock coming, so that I was running 1,500 chickens all the time. And if you don't think that was a full-time job, you're mistaken. However, as a result of that, we paid for all of the repair work that we did on the farm. Mm-hmm. And it enabled me, at the time of Carl's death, to claim joint ownership, which is very hard to prove. You have to prove you've contributed.
What? Oh, you mightn't have had ownership of
no.
it.
No. Oh, even though it's written in the deed and all. Oh. And it, in other words, we went around the Wisconsin marital law. However, I'm now caught in it because I can't claim owning the farm alone because Ann owns half of it.
Yeah.
Ann owns Carl's half. And I don't have any of the advantages of, and I think my entire allowance is $4,000 off income tax, inheritance tax.
And you should, it should be more, you mean it?
Well, the farm is now, that we paid $16,000 for in 1949, is worth $190,000. Mm-hmm. And we put about $40,000 into it. That's what where the money from the for legs went. But every year, we would do just a little bit more. We'd save what money we could, and then that year we'd do another batch of repairing, and we gradually repaired every building but one on the place.
Must have been very satisfying to be.
It was,
to do that.
And of course it kept me from. I never was one of these people who could go out and play bridge all afternoon. I didn't, in the first place, I didn't like it. In the second place, I couldn't afford to play bridge for money, and everybody wanted to pay for money.
Yeah. Do many people do that? Do you think faculty, what many faculty wives do that?
Well, I know very few who don't.
That's a world that we're not familiar with, isn't
it? I'm familiar with it.
Are you?
Yeah.
Really?
You know what I mean. It's very embarrassing to suddenly say, well, I'm sorry, I can't afford that.
Yeah.
And you've got to take one stand or the other. I know, but you've got to take one stand or the other.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's a penny, a point, or a quarter, or what. And we were so poor that from the very beginning, we simply said, we can't play bridge if we have to play for money.
I see. So you do like to play bridge, but just...
Oh, I love it. Love it. I play bridge any time of the day. But I don't play for money. And people never have. Until I went to see my daughter in Florida after Carl died. But anyhow, that... Doing the eggs to a very definite extent filled a gap. But by that time, I really wasn't a faculty wife except, of course, I have, there are thousands of foreign students who've been here, and every year when the seminar had its annual party, they came out here for a picnic. And sometimes we had as many as 78.
Yeah. And you organized that, presumably?
I ran it, yeah. The first year I gave them fried chicken, but I learned not to. I gave them home-cured ham and spoon bread. And
deviled eggs?
And deviled eggs. And then I always had something else, like the cream chicken with noodles and green beans, you know, one of those mixed casseroles, dinner in a dish. And I always just had a buffet supper.
Yeah.
But I was never one who was willing to settle for paper plates or paper cups. And nobody was allowed to wash dishes in my house. That was the rule.
I I'd like to have you say whether you think, it's quite obvious listening to you, but I'm just curious, how much of an impact you think faculty wives have on the university, and your own, whether you had an impact, and in what, aside from your career, your work as a nursery school and that sort of thing, but as a wife, what is your assessment? Because, you know, nowadays, faculty wives are not doing what you did. They're not giving enormous parties for foreign students. Not many of them, I think.
Well, you know, I still get Christmas cards from all over the world from these graduate students who have been in this seminar. People stop me on the street and say, "You don't remember me, Mrs. Bergholt, but I am." I mean, old high school friends of Anne's. And I think that the only impact I had as a faculty wife was as a hostess for my husband. I don't think I affected anything else.
You don't.
But he was always the person who was ready to entertain departmentally. If a new person came, we would invite people to meet the new person in the department. And very often the official chairman doesn't do that. They ought to.
Yes, that's expected.
But for instance, I remember when Arthur Garnett came here. He was an Australian who was in ethics. And he had been at Butler, and he was brought here as an associate professor. Nobody in the department had ever met him or heard of him. He just appeared. And about a year and a half after he got here, he came to Carl and asked him if he would introduce him to Paul Naplin in the history department. And he said, "Haven't you met him?" And he said, "No." So we ran a party for the Garnets to meet the Dean Selwyn,
mm-hmm.
history people, all around. We had about 50 people in because nobody was doing it. And we've done that sort of thing ever since. mm-hmm. And I have a host of former students that I hear from who come and see me. And that way, for instance, Carlos Castillo, who's in Costa Rica, always stays here when he's up here. He's done that for 20 years.
Mm.
We gave his PhD party for him when he got it. And we've done that for, I suppose, a dozen of them. But it's always in that way. I don't think I, as a person, and politically, I didn't attempt to sell the Democratic Party to the faculty, the people who were pro-Democratic came to me, for instance, Bob Reynolds, Billy Herbert Page.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few of them who were always Democrats. But in the early years, there were very few of them. But now, of course, there's a whole host of them.
Yes. Yeah.
I think, as a matter of fact, the whole administration is pro-liberal.
Mm, yeah.
I don't know all of the administration. I have just met O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
I have just met Shane. Well, of course, I know Bright Curl. Quite a lot of them.
I think.